reporting on the shutdown and the border wall, plus campaigners for Black Lives.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, January 14th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen the film Dirty Dancing, where Baby learns about love, adult responsibility, and the dirty boogie. Again, that's Dirty Dancing, showing Monday, January 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 21st from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the river at Jansen Beach. King County Councilor Larry Gossett will be the keynote speaker for the Scanner Foundation's 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast. Gossett, who was first elected to the King County Council in 1993, served as chair of the entire council in 2007 and 2013. Again, that's the 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 21st from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the river at Jansen Beach, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. The U.S. government remains shut down over Trump's border wall. It is the second longest shutdown in U.S. history. Last night, Donald Trump, in a primetime nationally televised address, used racism, fear, divisiveness, and lies to make his case for a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The Democrats are saying Trump's war is immoral. What is the reality? What is happening to migrants at the border? What is the explanation for the deaths of two migrant children, the latest on Christmas Eve? Our guest is Mexico-based journalist and writer Jose Luis Granado Ceja. And for our Campaigners for Black Lives series, we speak with Taz of Nashville Black Lives Matter. We discuss the case of Cyntoia Brown, who was recently given clemency for killing a man who had bought her for sex. Cyntoia Brown was forced into prostitution by a pimp. And Harold Meyerson, editor of The American Prospect, joins us on California's new governor, Gavin Newsom. What it means not only for California, but implications for the nation. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work directly, bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Apologies, we do not have our news headlines today. Computer trouble. So our news headlines will be back tomorrow, but we're now going to go directly to the first segment of our show. With the partial U.S. government shutdown stretching into a third week, Donald Trump delivered a primetime Oval Office address to the country on Tuesday, January 8th, on what he interestingly called the humanitarian and national security crisis on our southern border. During his address, he reiterated that there is a crisis at the border, but offered no new policy approach. His main concern was with the security, he said, of the United States. He was not concerned about the health and well-being of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. He did not declare a national emergency, as some has feared. He had talked about declaring a national emergency, but he stopped short of doing that. His speech was about 9 minutes, and he painted a misleading and bleak picture of the situation of the border. Basically, he used racism, divisiveness, and lies in making his case. Let us go now to a clip on the situation at the border. You know, Sarah Sanders, to give it some context, has said that, you know, doctors did everything they could, that the U.S. did nothing wrong with the death of the migrant boy who died on Christmas Eve. That's a clip from CNN. And also we have a clip on Trump versus the Dems on the border crisis. Are we able to do that one first, the Trump versus Dems on the border crisis? Let's go to that.
My fellow Americans.
Tonight, I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border.
We address you tonight for one reason only. The President of the United States, having failed to get Mexico to pay for his ineffective, unnecessary border wall, and unable to convince the Congress or the American people to foot the bill, has shut down the government.
Over the years, thousands of Americans have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered our country, and thousands more lives will be lost if we don't act right now.
Tonight, and throughout this debate and throughout his presidency, President Trump has appealed to fear, not facts, division, not unity.
Last month, 20,000 migrant children were illegally brought into the United States, a dramatic increase. These children are used as human pawns by vicious coyotes and ruthless gangs.
The women and children at the border are not a security threat. They are a humanitarian challenge, a challenge that President Trump's own cruel and counterproductive policies have only deepened.
The federal government remains shut down for one reason and one reason only, because Democrats will not fund border security.
There is bipartisan legislation supported by Democrats and Republicans to reopen government while allowing debate over border security to continue. There is no excuse for hurting millions of Americans over a policy difference.
All righty. So there you have it. And I'd like to welcome our guest back, Jose Luis Granado Ceja, writer, photojournalist based in Mexico City. He previously worked as a staff writer for Telesur and currently works on a freelance basis. His stories focus on contemporary political issues, particularly those that involve grassroots efforts to affect social change. He often covers the work of social and labor movements in Latin America. Jose, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, Jose, before we talk about the actual situation on the border, I wondered if you had a chance to hear Donald Trump's speech and the Democratic response. And I wondered your reaction to the speech, because some Democrats, some prominent Republicans, including Senator Lindsey Graham and Senator Mitch McConnell, seemed impressed with Trump's speech. Of course, the Democrats slammed Trump's remarks. But there's a lot of fact-checking that's been going on Trump's claims, including his basic thing that there is a security crisis at the southern border. I mean, I would agree that there's a humanitarian crisis at the southern border, but that is due to U.S. policy. Your reaction to the speech?
I think your summary of it, including using the words racism, is absolutely correct. This is a political position that he is taking for political ends. He is trying to shore up support, rally his base, try to keep his party, the Republican Party, together amidst this political crisis, the government shutdown that he created by being so intransigent with respect to this funding of the border wall. And I think it needs to be always seen from that lens, that this isn't about the border. This isn't even about his alleged, you know, security situation on the southern U.S. border. This is about politics, and it's about him trying to save face in light of this situation where, to their credit, the Democrats are actually being tough on this issue and saying that they won't fund this border wall. Because even if we were to take his policy stances at face value to say that this border wall is necessary for border security, it won't actually accomplish those goals. It would be a massive waste of resources in a country that has a lot of challenges right now. And if they're so interested in spending money on the border, what needs to happen is attending to the humanitarian crisis that does exist, that has been generated, as you said, by U.S. policy. What we need to see on the U.S. border isn't a wall, but rather speeding up of processing of claims so that people are not living in these camps on the border waiting for their chance to claim asylum.
Right. And I mean, Trump's very radical views that would have been considered a fringe even among Republicans some years back now seem to be mainstream. And Stephen Miller, his policy guy on immigration, is really having a heyday pushing forward all of these attacks, not only on migrants, but even on green card holders in the United States, on immigration generally, all part of his America First, or what some people call Make America White. I wouldn't say again, because as we know, it was populated with indigenous people. So given the whole debate about a wall versus steel, do you think that really makes much of a difference? I mean, Trump said that the Democrats requested steel, but that's not really true. Jose.
Yeah, it's not true at all. I mean, even if we're talking about, let's say, drugs crossing the border, the drugs tend to cross actually through regular points. The DEA, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, found that 90% of smuggled heroin went through designated ports of entry, such as like a regular crossing. So this idea that the wall is going to stop drugs coming in, it's not going to do that. That it's going to stop people from entering irregularly, it's not going to do that. Because the truth is that actually that kind of what is called illegal entry has gone down. It's in historic lows. People that are actually reaching the United States are mostly doing it because they're refugees or they're asylum seekers, and that's the means that people are crossing. So a border wall won't really do anything. You can build a wall, but people are still going to try to enter via the regular points in order to claim asylum and ask for refugee status inside of the United States.
Yeah, and you know, the divisiveness, I mean, it was early in his speech, Donald Trump said that the people who are suffering the most from this invasion from the southern border are Black people and Latino people living in the United States. I mean, your comment on that, because this kind of divide and rule is not a new tactic, but clearly he's, you know, trying to cause some division here. Jose.
Absolutely. I think we can't take him seriously when he claims to be a champion of oppressed communities, of Black communities, of Latin American communities in the United States. It's ridiculous, because you just have to look at his actions and with any other policies and the way that he's treated these communities. So he's not interested in that. But he's precisely doing that, trying to divide and rule. And like I said at the beginning, the motivation behind this is rallying, mobilizing his white base in light of looming elections. Those midterm elections didn't go well for him or his party. He tried to make the issue of the day immigration. It didn't work. We saw this change in the Congress of more support for the Democrats. It's going to make his life as president more complicated. And so he's already thinking what's going to happen 2 years down the road when he faces or attempts to run for re-election. And that's what this is actually about. And so he knows that mobilizing his white base, which is racist, which is anti-Mexican, which is anti-Central American, by stirring up this conversation around border security is a means for him to rally support and possibly, you know, gather enough support to be able to be reelected.
Right. Okay. And also, another claim that Trump made was thousands of people in the United States who have been brutally, he says, thousands of Americans. By the way, the people coming from south of the border, they're also Americans. People tend to forget that. We're talking about thousands of people living in the United States. You know, Canada is part of America, so is Central and Latin America, and we do tend to forget that. But he says thousands of Americans, by his definition, have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered the U.S. Your response and reaction to that?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a means of trying to stir up fear. It's a classic move by far right populists, what could also be called fascism. That this idea that the enemy other, this an invasion other, presents a threat to you and your family. But even the Cato Institute, which is funded by large business businessmen, the libertarian group, even they said that crime rates among immigrants in Texas were lower than those amongst native-born Americans. So it's just trying to stir up. And I'd like to actually point to something that the Mexican Interior Minister, her name is Olga Sanchez Cordero, actually said in response to some of these fear-mongering that's been happening. And to quote, she said, "Migrants are not criminals, much less do they constitute a threat to the security of Mexico or the United States. They are human beings who seek to escape the reality of insecurity and poverty in their countries of origin, who seek the most elemental thing, the possibility of remaining alive and finding a job that will allow them to advance with dignity." And I think that's actually the important the way that we should look at this migration. They're human beings who are trying to escape basically a death sentence if they stay in their countries of origin.
Right, and we're going to go there next in terms of what is actually happening at the border. What are the conditions that migrants are living in, which in itself is a humanitarian crisis. Two children so far have died, a young girl and a young boy. And I'd like to, before we start, that get your input on this, Jose. Let's go to a clip from CNN of doctors who are saying Sarah Sanders, who speaks for the president, was wrong, or speaks for Donald Trump, was wrong on the migrant boy's death.
"We are learning the 8-year-old who died while in U.S. Border Patrol custody had the flu. Little Felipe Gomez Alonso died on Christmas Eve. He'd been detained with his father in New Mexico. He's the second child to die in U.S. Border Patrol custody this month. The White House says the deaths show exactly why the nation's immigration laws need an overhaul."
"Certainly, that's a absolutely tragic situation, something nobody ever wants to see happen. It's one of the reasons that the president wants to fix our broken immigration system. It's a treacherous journey, and we don't want to see people go that route. We are doing everything in our capacity to make sure that when people do come, that they're taken care of so that we don't have these type of instances. In many cases, they show up extremely dehydrated, without food, and they're seeing a doctor for the very first time.
CNN senior medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen joins me now. You know, we just heard Sarah Sanders say they're doing everything they can do. What are the experts you've talked to saying about how things are being done for the children that are coming across the border?
Brian, the infectious disease experts I'm talking to say that simply is not true, that there were some very simple and obvious medical steps that could have been taken here. So this boy was taken to the hospital with signs of the flu. The border protection people were very clear about that. He had possible signs of the flu, but from what we're told, he was not given a flu test. And so without that test, he didn't get treatment for the flu, and he was sent back to the detention center. So not only is that bad for this boy, obviously in this tragic situation, but he then went back to a detention center where he could infect other people. This boy had a 103-degree fever. I know at my child's school, you don't let a child back in school after they've had a 103-degree fever, but he was let back into a detention facility, which we don't know about this particular one, but many of them have been very crowded. Who knows who else he infected? So no, the doctors I'm talking to say they feel the opposite. They say that Sarah Sanders is not telling the truth.
All right. So Jose Luis Granados Ceja, our guest here based in Mexico City. You know, what is shocking about I mean, there's a lot shocking about what we just heard. We know two children have died early December, a young girl, Jacqueline Kyle McKean, and on Christmas Eve, Felipe Alonso Gomez. Now, and that who was 8 years old, the girl was 7 years old. In that clip, we hear a medical correspondent say that Felipe had a fever of 103. Now, we know that the flu is dangerous. I don't know if this child was also checked for pneumonia, which is a killer. How do you release somebody with 103 fever, a young, vulnerable child, back, you know, into a camp where conditions are such that they're described as a humanitarian crisis? Jose, just your reaction to this.
Yeah, it sort of points to the dehumanization of asylum seekers.
Right.
The clip was interesting in that it says it's true. A child wouldn't be let back into school under those conditions and in that health situation that young boy found himself in. It just shows that there is less regard for their lives. They're treated as lesser, even though that they deserve our protection and our support. It's heartbreaking to hear things like that. And it's interesting where the migrants are held if they're in detention on the U.S. side of the border. Migrants themselves call the pens that they're held in hieleras, or ice boxes. So can you imagine a young boy with that medical situation in an ice box? And, you know, it's not a surprise that ultimately the lack of medical attention cost him his life, and that's a violation of his human rights. That's a duty that the United States has, if they have him under detention, to care for him, and they failed in that regard. And I think, again, to bring it back to the political side of things, the reason that migrants choose to, for example, the first case of the Guatemalan girl who died, you know, they were forced to cross at these dangerous points because people were becoming frustrated or being forced to live in these squalid camps waiting for their turn to ask for asylum. The crux of the problem here is the metering that the United States is doing in order to dissuade migrants. It's very purposeful. They don't want migrants to come and ask for asylum, so they make it as difficult as possible so that people basically get frustrated and turn back or decide not to apply at all. But other people know that going back is not an option, so they cross by whatever means necessary, including taking some risk in terms of how they're crossing through deserts, crossing through cold nights. And this is why they find themselves in a situation. No, the problem is not the parents who are taking. The problem is the United States, which is not giving the attention that they must be giving, they should be giving to asylum seekers.
Right. And Jose, what we're going to do now is just have some of our listeners who can get through to us weigh in a bit on their response to what Trump had to say and what's happening at the border. What are your thoughts on what Trump had to say? What are your thoughts on the situation at the border? We'll put as many of you up on the air as we can, and we'll have time just to fit in a few guests. So you just need to call early to get in. We want to hear your thoughts. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Meanwhile, Jose, as we're waiting for some calls to come in there, tell us a bit about what you know about the actual conditions in the camps where the migrants are basically being held.
Yeah, these are very difficult situations that the migrants are finding themselves in. These camps are largely improvised. So while Mexico is very much used to people traveling through the country in order to reach the United States, this phenomenon that we're seeing as of late, the caravans, it means that there are mass arrivals. Instead of just a few people arriving a little bit at a time, we're having thousands of people who are coming and seeking asylum in the United States. And that's creating a lot of pressure in terms of being able to receive them. The difficulty is also, you know, Mexico also has a lot of conflicting opinions. Mexican politicians have conflicting opinions about how to handle this crisis. We saw a really negative response from the mayor of Tijuana, who tried to stir up xenophobic attitudes against the migrants in that city. But at the same time, in Mexico City, you had this huge camp set up with, you know, medical attention and food and services and even psychological care for the migrants in a sports complex. And so there's a bit of an uneven response. But the idea is to try to make the situation as comfortable and as dignified, which is the word I try to use with respect to this, as possible. That's what we have right now. It is not dignified. You know, you have people who are basically waiting hours in long lines just to get a plate of food because they're not able to, you know, work outside of or seek work inside of Mexico, which is also informing a bit the response of the new Mexican government with respect to the migrants. So now the priority is to try to get people in order to register to enter Mexico in an orderly fashion is the word that the Interior Minister uses. Mexico's border is pretty porous. You know, there's regular crossing points, but really just down the road there's there's rafts that you can cross the Suchiapia River and
okay.
come into Mexico.
Hold that thought, Jose, yeah. because we do have some callers coming in. We'd like to hear from them. Let's go to Joe in Highland Park. Joe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Margaret. Yes, I do actually agree that there is, like your guest has been saying, and you've been saying, a humanitarian crisis, but it isn't only at the border. The one that is at the border is the result of the humanitarian crisis in these people's homelands. That is in part created by U.S. government and military and corporate policy, and that's barely mentioned. Of course, on KPFK, we hear about it from time to time, but I think that's a central point. It challenges the right of protecting the border from people entering, but not protecting the border from being an entry point for super profits extracted from these countries,
yeah.
or U.S. military aid going to those countries. If it were really a wall that prevented U.S. intervention in those countries, and prevented the drainage of profits from underpaid labor, oppressed labor in those countries, well, that might be something to consider. But as it is, it's not really a wall. It's permeable to all of those other things.
That's
but
right.
just not the people when they try to follow what's been taken from their labor, from their environment, from their homelands, and from their lives.
Okay,
they are the witnesses to theft, witnesses to armed theft that's been carried out.
All righty.
And neither side in the U.S. debate, the Dems or the Republicans, wants to respect and deal with that.
Okay, Joe, your point is well taken. We want to get some other folks up here on the line. Your thoughts on Trump's speech last night and also on what's happening at the border. Let's hear from Kevin in Van Nuys.
Yes, hi. My name is Kevin. I'm an American citizen and a United States military veteran. And I have been shunted aside in favor of migrants of one sort or another. So I'm in complete agreement with President Trump and his conclusions. And right. I would like to see this wall up too.
Okay. Kevin, Jose, there you have it. You have two callers, Kevin and Van Nuys, who is saying he is agreeing with Trump, Joe having another view. Let's just get some final thoughts from you, Kevin, and for other people who have called. We're running a bit out of time. We might be able to squeeze in one other caller. Again, the number is 818-985-5735. But let's see, Jose, your reaction here to these calls and just some of your final thoughts.
It's interesting because if we look at both of the responses, at the end of the day, the truth is what this is that it's a political system, political institutions that are designed to generate profits for private business, to generate capital for these businesses. It's true. Absolutely. Part of the reason that we're seeing this migration crisis is because of policies supported by the United States through their foreign policy that lead to suffering, to impoverishment, to inequality in these countries of origin. And at the same time, the second caller felt that, that he is losing out as a result of the attention being paid to migrants. But, migrants play a huge role in the U.S. economy. The idea of having this workforce that they don't have to respect labor law, that they can be paid less than the legal minimum wage. And so all of this, our enemy aren't each other. My enemy is not the U.S. worker. My enemy is the U.S. bosses, the people who are promoting these policies that are leading to all of us suffering.
Yeah, and Jose, you know, the other thing is that the reality is even if all undocumented people, let's say in a state like California or in the United States, somehow left the country, the economy, certainly in the state of California, I'm not quite sure about the other states, would basically practically grind to a halt. So when people are saying, well, you know, I'm, you know, migrants or immigrants are a disadvantage for me, I don't know that they understand the reality and the actual financial and other contributions that migrants and immigrants, undocumented or not, make to the economy of the United States and to states like California. Jose.
Yes, precisely. And so, with anything, what we would like to see is more of an extension of a hand of solidarity to these countries. If you don't want to see migrant caravans showing up at the southern border, then oppose U.S. foreign policy that's generating this. I mean, most of the migrants in this latest round of caravans come from Honduras. Honduras is a country that is effectively a dictatorship that is propped up by the United States. If the United States withdrew its support, that government would fall maybe overnight. We're seeing the same thing with the situation in Guatemala with another U.S. puppet there in Jimmy Morales, who is also looking to get reelected. And I know that if he tries to push for that, he will receive support from the U.S. Department of State. And so U.S. citizens, U.S. residents need to oppose the policies that generate these kinds of situations where people are fleeing. One thing that we say a lot in Mexico is that no one really wants to leave, right? People would rather be where their families are. People would rather be where their culture is. They leave because they have to. And so if we can change the situation so that people can stay in their countries of origin, stay close to their culture and their family, and lead productive, dignified lives where they're not worried about how to keep a roof over their head, then you won't see these kinds of migration. But at the same time, if people want to leave, they also have the right to leave. They have the right to go out and choose to live a new country and make a new life for themselves.
Right. And did we lose Chris online? Okay. So we lost. There were a couple of other callers coming in, but we are really out of time also for this particular segment. Jose, yet again, we do know that there are thousands of migrants still left at the border. There are reports that some of them have actually decided to stay in Mexico at the offer of the new Mexican government, and some of them are returning back home. But have you sensed any improvement in the conditions? Just a quick thing on that. Or have you heard about conditions?
Yeah. There is a priority, and I think even the organizations on the ground recognize that there's at least a very different attitude from the new government of López Obrador in terms of actually trying to attend to the needs of the caravan, of trying to make things a little bit more orderly. Now, there's some critique around that, saying that perhaps they're being a little bit too strict on trying to make sure that everybody who crosses does so at an official point and with documentation. We know that refugees often don't have documentation. But the point is that they're actually specifically saying that their aim is to comply with their human rights of the migrants. So the idea is that people who want to stay in Mexico will get permits to stay in Mexico. If they want to seek asylum in Mexico, they will be granted the process to seek asylum. Those that want to continue through the country to reach the United States will also get visas in order to transit visas so that they can do that. So it's a very different attitude. It's not, you know, a baton trying to keep them from entering the country. You know, the idea is not to do Trump's dirty work on the southern border. People are welcome to come in as long as they try to do it in an orderly fashion is the new priority of the government. But the idea is to support their human rights, of course.
Right. Well, Jose, thank you so very much for joining us yet again. That is Jose Luis Granado Ceja, writer and journalist based in Mexico City, formerly worked as staff for Telesur, now a freelance journalist. Jose, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We are going to take our station break, and when we return, the case of Centoya Brown, who was granted clemency after 15 years in prison, and also coming up, the journalist Harold Marison, editor of the American Prospect, joins us to discuss California's new governor. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is KBOO. It's 8:34. Coming up at 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. Flashpoints at 10. At 11 on Between the Covers, they present Book Waves and an interview with author Katia Sengel about her new book, Exiled, From the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. At 11:30, Words and Pictures talks to Jason Lutz about his epic graphic novel, Berlin, that tells the story of struggling German civilians between the wars. This is KBOO.
Lean on Me. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And if you are a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Lots of information that we post there. And also our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. We're also on SoundCloud. So just look on SoundCloud for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. There you'll find a description of each of our shows, and our shows are archived there. In the U.S., in the tradition of Sojourner Truth, we like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Pearland, Texas. I'll look that up to see where Pearland is. And internationally, I would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Brazil. Again, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now we are going to go to our segment, our regular series of Campaigners for Black Lives. And we want to thank Black Lives Matter LA, in particular Dr. Melina Abdullah, who partnered with us for the Campaigners for Black Lives series. Let us go. We're going to be discussing the case of Cyntoia Brown. Let's go to a CNN clip on Cyntoia.
Her attorney, Charles Bone. Charles, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate it. First and foremost, I want to ask you, how is she doing, and is she aware of this new public campaign to try to help her?
Cyntoia is a remarkable young woman, and she's very aware. She's amazed by the publicity that's been generated this week.
Help us understand who she is now. I understand, I mean, she's been in prison for what?
Yeah, we're going to continue that clip, but also I just want to make sure everybody knows who Cyntoia Brown is. The New York Times is reporting that the governor of Tennessee granted clemency to her on Monday. She had a life sentence for killing a man who had picked her up for sex. She was a trafficking victim. She was trafficked by her pimp. She had a very, very difficult childhood, wound up on the streets. And in this situation, she says it was a case of self-defense because she feared for her life. And we also know that men who are after doing harm to women, well, there's a lot of domestic violence that goes on, but in terms of women who are strangers, we know that in terms of murder and violence against women, that women who are sex workers are the most vulnerable. Among other things, they are an illegal population. So this granting of clemency to Cyntoia Brown is very significant here. Let us continue with the CNN clip.
Prison for what? Has it been about 13 years and she's gotten a college degree? Is that right?
13 years, and she's gotten her GED and her Associate of Arts degree from Lipscomb University, and now she's very close to getting her bachelor's degree.
She, if what I read from her background is correct, suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome. She grew up in an abusive home where drugs were rampant. She ran away from adoptive parents. She was raped and forced into prostitution by a pimp, as I understand it.
Yeah, ran away from adoptive parent. You know, we hear that again and again. Certainly one of the victims, the youngest victim of the serial murderer known as the Grim Sleeper here in Southern California, Princess, she also ran away from an adoptive family, and we hear that far too often. I'd like to welcome our guest, Taz. Taz is an activist and organizer with Black Lives Matter Nashville, as well as a graduate student at Vanderbilt University. Taz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Okay, so Taz, your response to the Santoya Brown case, also the significance of it, and even to hear the lawyer speak in the clip or press reports, you know, credit is being given to the governor or even the lawyer, but just in terms of the movement on the ground that really brought this case to the light of day, not much credit given there. Taz, your reaction.
Yeah, so first about what this win means, I think that clemency being granted is an extreme win for everyone. I remember sitting in the car with one of my friends, and when I got the news, I immediately was in tears. And that's pretty much the same reaction with the other organizers who have been doing the groundwork on behalf of Black Lives Matter Nashville. So when we talk about credit, I think credit, we're not looking for credit. I think that Black Lives Matter Nashville has received a lot of credit from our participation since December 10th, but we want to always affirm and uplift the fact that there have been people who have been doing this work since 2004. And so for us, this is just a collective win. There is no credit that needs to be given except to Santoya herself. Santoya has been doing the work for herself on the inside of prison. She's worked on her degree. She's worked on herself. I mean, we're just supporting the efforts that she's already made. So if any credit needs to be given, it is definitely to Santoya, not to Governor Haslam, not to BLM Nashville or anyone else, but to Santoya, because we are just, again, amplifying the work that she was already doing for herself.
Right. And indeed, the someone from Black Lives Matter Nashville, Brittany Paschal, was quoted in the New York Times article on Santoya Brown. And I only mention that because all too often people feel you can't fight City Hall. There's no point to campaigning or organizing. So when there's a win and activists on the ground have participated in it, you know, I do think it's important for people to know. I mean, this case blew up on social media. Part of it is that the likes of Rihanna from my home country of Barbados, she was on this case. So just tell us then not only about the role of social media, but also the very controversial discussion that's going on now about putting children in prison. I mean, she was 16 years old when this all happened.
Right. And so really quickly, I think, so just to lift up Brittany Paschal and Justin Lang and myself, I think that for us, social media, we are all young organizers. We've been doing organizing work for various amount of times, but we're still, you know, young in age.
Yeah.
And I think social media is very important for us. That is definitely a way that we get to reach folks. With the action when we disrupted Governor Haslam for his education forum, when we shut down the Nashville streets, we use our social media platforms and our social networks to really make these things possible. So I think that social media played a huge part in continuing to bring, of course, that light to this. And then when we talk about, you know, putting children in prison, one, prison shouldn't exist. That's just period. But especially when we talk about children being in prison, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, I think that was in 2012, that no child should serve a life sentence in prison, right? And so because Santoya was arrested in 2004, that, you know, that did not apply to her. But for us, it is something that is really important that we make sure that we stop sending children to prisons. We stop sending folks to prisons in general, but especially when we're talking about kids who, like Santoya, was at the intersection of being Black, woman, and child. That's something that's really important, that we look at those nuances when we're looking at cases like this.
Right. And for people who want to be in touch with Black Lives Matter Nashville and perhaps find out more about what you're doing, tell us what they should do. And also, any thoughts, that are there any residual demands, so to speak, now that she has been granted clemency, that people think still need to be made in relation to her case?
Got it. So first, I want to amplify the work of Survive and Punish. They've been doing continuous work on criminalized survival for years, so I want to uplift that. The way that you can stay in touch with BLM Nashville is following us on any of our social media platforms. We are BLM underscore Nashville, and we hope to continue to provide updates on how folks can stay plugged in. And then for myself, I'm MTGAINES underscore, and I can answer a lot of questions that way too. I think the only demand that we have right now is to continue to support Centoya. So most folks know that Centoya does not get out until August 7th, which will be 15 years to the date since she was arrested. So she's still going to be in prison. So we ask folks to still write her letters, still put money on her commissary using JPay and or MoneyGram to send her that support while she's still in there. And then the only other demand is that when she does get out is that we support her in the best way that she wants to be supported, right? So, of course, a lot of people have all of these plans of what they want to do for Centoya, which is great. But Centoya is a thinker of her own. And so when she is out, we need to, as a community, show up in the way that she needs us to show up. But again, until then, we just ask the folks, write her letters. Just make sure that she feels that love, and then continue to put money on her book.
All righty. Thank you, Taz, activist and organizer with Black Lives Matter Nashville. Thank you. And good luck with your graduate studies work at Vanderbilt,
Taz.
Thank
you so much. Thank you for having me again.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, on Monday, January 7th, Gavin Newsom was officially sworn in as California's 40th governor. Newsom, a longtime Democrat and a self-described progressive, served on San Francisco Board of Supervisors and then as the city's mayor for 7 years. During last November's gubernatorial elections, Newsom defeated his Republican rival, John H. Cox, with 61.9% of votes in a major sweep. The 51-year-old politician and former businessman has replaced Jerry Brown, who was also a Democrat, who served as governor of California from 1975 to 1983, from 2011 to 2019. Let us go now to hear just a short piece of what Gavin Newsom had to say in his inauguration speech.
We face serious challenges, undoubtedly, some that have been deferred for too long. And even in a booming economy, you know, there's this disquieting sense, right, that things are not as predictable as they once were, that we almost now run a little bit faster just to stay in place. Stagnant wages, costs that keep rising, rent, utilities, visiting the doctor, the basics are increasingly out of reach. We face a gulf between the rich and everyone else. And it's not just inequality of wealth, it's inequality of opportunity. And we have a homeless epidemic that should keep each and every one of us up at night. An achievement gap in our schools, and a readiness gap that holds back millions of our kids. And too many children know the ache of chronic hunger. I have met families in this state who have to improvise where to tuck their babies in at night, making nests out of blankets on the floor or turning dresser drawers into makeshift cradles because they cannot afford a crib. These aren't merely policy problems. They are moral imperatives. And so long as they persist, each and every one of us is diminished. You know, we're all touched by the human condition. Whether we ourselves are homeless or jobless, whether we ourselves can pay the bills or have safe drinking water at home, we all have our own frailties. We all have our own vulnerabilities, and we're all susceptible to suffering and disaster. So let us resolve to follow the example of the rescuers and the rebuilders in Paradise and Malibu and Santa Rosa and Ventura, and to make sure our fellow Californians share in the compassion and empathy that connects us and makes our burdens and anxieties easier to bear.
All righty. So I'd now like to welcome our guest. We're delighted to have on the air with us Harold Meyerson, editor of the American Prospect. For more than a decade, he served as a weekly op-ed columnist for the Washington Post, writing chiefly on politics and the economy. He's a contributing columnist to the op-ed page of the Los Angeles Times. He's an award-winning journalist. The Atlantic has called him one of the nation's 50 most influential editorial opinion journalists. He's contributed articles to the New Yorker, New York Times, Atlantic, New Republic, Nation, Dissent, The Guardian, New Statesman, and numerous other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome.
Glad to be here, Margaret.
Okay. Before Harold Meyerson, we hear your thoughts on the significance of Gavin Newsom being governor and your thoughts on what he has laid out so far. You are a public school kid in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I am. And I had a great education. That was eons ago. I just had the 50th reunion of my class at Palisades High, ninth class of 1968, which was a hell of a year.
Yeah, it certainly was a hell of a year.
I ended up in the Democratic Convention in Chicago getting clobbered by a cop in the summer of 68. But yes, and I obviously am closely watching what's going on with the
right.
teachers. They are facing, you know, an ongoing crisis of privatization and charterization of public schools in California, to segue to Gavin Newsom, still are really underfunded compared to schools in other states. And there's a, you know, so I would support the teachers in what they do, and what they're asking for isn't simply a raise for themselves. What they're asking for is really greater commitment to public education, and that's what Los Angeles and California badly need.
Right, and now on Newsom, right, he's talked about health care. Some people are criticizing and saying, well, in his speech he didn't exactly come out for single payer, even though in the campaign he was talking about single payer. Anyway, your thoughts on what he's laid out on health insurance, for example.
Well, actually, I mean, I think that's the most substantive thing he has done thus far. On health insurance, you can't get to single payer unless the federal government agrees to a number of changes, including letting the state utilize the funding for Medicare and such. And so he did say he would petition Trump and the Congress to do that. Clearly, they're not going to do that. But even if he had submitted a bill on day one for single payer and it passed and he signed it, it would still be in abeyance until he gets the go-ahead from D.C., which is, you know, unimaginable until there's a Democratic president and the Democratic Senate, and that they're, you know, that they themselves are committed to letting single payer go in one state. But what he did do that I thought was particularly significant was consolidate the buying power of Medi-Cal, which is the California version of Medicaid, so that the agency could bargain with the drug companies on behalf of the 13 million Californians who are on the Medi-Cal program, which gives them really huge market power. And this could really be, I think, a significant way to bring down drug prices, which is one of the major reasons why healthcare costs have just soared, and also to allow a buy-in to this program from individuals and companies, so that, you know, it could be 13 million, 14 million, 15 million, 16 million. You know, with numbers like that, you begin to get real clout and a real pressure on drug companies, something that they have managed, you know, artfully and by making campaign contributions to any politician who'll take them, that they've up to now managed to avoid. So I think that is really significant. Plus, he extended Medicaid availability to up to now the state has covered undocumented immigrants up to the ages up to the age of 18. He's extending that to the age of 25. So he's certainly moving in the right direction. Also, just in general, Gavin Newsom is a mainstream liberal, and what he reflects is the move of mainstream liberals over the last decade or so, particularly since Bernie Sanders kind of changed what's in the political discourse, the move of mainstream liberals to the left. He's not a radical. He's not a socialist. But he reflects the movement of mainstream liberals leftward, and I think his inaugural address and his initial commitments reflect that shift.
Right, and there was some disappointment, though, in terms of the environment and what he has said about the environment. I mean, Brown was so strong on the environment. I wondered if you had any thoughts on that. But also the national implications. I mean, when you talked about bargaining separately with drug companies on prices, I mean, that could have national implications if something like that works. Is that the case?
It sure could. Mm-hmm. It sure could. If you recall, Justice Brandeis referred to the states as laboratories of democracies, that a national right. program often gets, you know, it gets its pre-Broadway opening, gets its tryout in the states. Well, one of the effects of the midterm election is that there are a considerable number of states that now have Democratic administrations. California already, obviously, had a Democratic administration, but in general, Newsom is to the left of Jerry Brown, and, you know, the number of Democrats in the legislature has gone from just under two-thirds to, you know, three-quarters, which is, I don't know what you'd call that, beyond hegemonic or something. I mean, I mean, a number of those Democrats are relatively centrist, but he's positioning California with the drug purchasing and whatnot to be what Brandeis said, because, you know, the Democrats in the House, in the U.S. House of Representatives, also are looking at legislation to begin to increase the federal government's ability to bring down drug prices, and I think they'll be looking at California as a model. So, yeah, I think this has national implications, and if and when, knock wood, there's a Mr. Trump is not president anymore. You know, this is going to be one of the things that the Democrats would try to push through.
Right, and he's also said that California will continue to lead the resistance against Trump. Of course, some of the more liberal conservatives, they always, you know, they always carry on about those of us on the left coast, right, and being, you mm-hmm. know, extremists, etc. But just your thoughts on that, because we're seeing a number of other Democratic governors now in place.
Well, I mean, at this point, the initial form of resistance has taken shape all over the country, and you know, Attorney General in California, Javier Becerra, has sued the government, you know, I don't know how many times now, you can lose count, and that's going to continue, and certainly there, you know, you're not going to see anything but resistance and opposition to Trump's loony wall project. That's certainly going to continue. And on the environment, I would expect that in general, Newsom would pretty much follow the pattern of Jerry Brown. This is one of those areas where Brown, who, you know, was kind of a contrarian centrist in some ways, and on these issues, he was clearly a groundbreaking leader, and I would assume that actually at this juncture, almost any Democrat who would be governor would continue in that direction, because it's really sort of a mainstream position within California. California, even among Republicans, has been more environmentally conscious than other parts of the country, and will remain so.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm a mom, and I'm watching closely what he's saying about 6 months of paid leave for every time a family has in the state has a child. So we'll see how all of that works out. I mean, that was something.
And that would be groundbreaking nationally, too. No one has proposed it. No one in power has proposed it for 6 months, which is, you know, beginning to be adequate. So that's all for the good.
Oh, really? Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And for people who want to see what you have written on the new governor, Marison on Tap, the American Prospect, published on January 8th. But Harold Meyerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our engineer, board op, Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love.
Good morning. It's 8:58. This is KBOO Portland. Up next, Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell is here with the weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers presents Bookwaves and an interview with author Katia Sengel about her new book, Exiled, from the killing fields of Cambodia to California and back. At 11:30, Words and Pictures talks to Jason Lutz about his epic graphic novel, Berlin, that tells the story of struggling German civilians between the wars. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. Become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8:58. Press Watch next.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Don't Look Back on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Don't Look Back is a documentary film following Bob Dylan during a three-week concert tour of England in the spring of 1965. The film chronicles Dylan's concert appearances, hotel room conversations, and downtime, pulling back the curtain on Dylan on the cusp of his creative shift towards rock music. Again, that's Don't Look Back on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the film screening From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation, on Thursday, January 10th at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. From Shock to Awe follows the path of two combat veterans from the Iraq War as they live with post-traumatic stress, lack of effective treatment, and their search for healing and transformation through plant medicine journeys. Again, that's the film screening From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation, on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. Join me, won't you, for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination.